And you're tuned in to the Jewish Activist Network right here on AM 620. For those who are tuning in or trying to tune into Jewish Datelines, we apologize. There was some technical difficulties tonight, but Jewish Datelines will, God willing, continue next week. So be sure to tune in to the Jewish Datelines aspect or portion of Jewish Activist Network, which will be from 12 midnight on Wednesday night to 12:30. And now from 12:30 to 1 a.m., we're on with our segment here. I'm Joe Orla, your host. Our call-in number, 718-569-0921.
Thank you for being with us, 718-569-0921. As Joe mentioned, our website is www.jewishactivistnetwork.com. Our email address is media@jewishactivistnetwork.com. We are going to start off a little bit with the Parsha. In this Parsha, we have the B'nai Yisrael entering to the Yam Suf. And the B'nai Yisrael are in a state of fear, in a state of not knowing what to do. They begin out without fear after they come out of Mitzrayim. There's really no fear whatsoever. But then it turns to fear as soon as the Mitzrayim are chasing after them. And there's a very famous Ibn Ezra. And if it's not famous to you, hopefully after this show it will be famous to you. And the general question that he asks is, how could it be that the Jewish people that has seen all the miracles in Egypt, they now melt with fear? And we know that it says, V'chamushim olu b'nei Yisrael me'eretz Mitzrayim. The B'nai Yisrael came out armed from the land of Egypt. In other words, you have 600,000, over 600,000 men of fighting age, between over 20 years old. They come in, and they come in and they see the Egyptians come to fight, and they just simply melt in fear. The question is, what's wrong with them? Why don't they stand up and fight? And the evidence gives a very interesting answer. And the answer is basically a psychological one. The reason that they melt in fear is you have to understand where they were coming from. For the last few hundred years, they were in slavery. It was them, it was their parents, it was their grandparents. Anytime they saw an Egyptian, they were frightened. They could be beaten at any time, and they were beaten. There was no such concept as standing up and saying, "No, Egyptian, you're doing the wrong thing. We did nothing wrong, and why are you hitting us? Because if you would do that, you would get beaten." Now, what happens with after a while when you get beaten is that you immediately go into a mode of self-protection, and you can't fight. And that's what happened to the children of Israel. They were not able to fight. They were not able to respond. And in fact, they couldn't get it out of their system so much that even after all the makos, after all the plagues that happened on the Egyptians, now when they saw their enemy chasing them, they melted in fear, and there was nothing they could do. This is what Ibn Ezra explains. This is something which is a psychological issue, something which we really should think about when you see people who make decisions, and the decisions don't seem logical. Not always is it a logical decision that people make. Very often it's an emotional decision. In fact, the B'nai Yisrael who came out of Egypt were not able to go into the land of Israel. And for 40 years they wandered in the desert until a new generation rose. Because it happened so often, 10 times, that they could not stand up and act as free people. Whether it was when there was a little bit of water that was lacking, or they didn't have a little bit of food for a short amount of time. Somebody has the spirit of freedom will tough it out. As we say, when the going gets tough, the tough get going. and there's a tough will tough it out, and they'll try to see what they can do about it. A person who's in a situation of slavery, eventually, they basically need to have things given to them. They're not used to doing things on their own. And basically, this is what happened to the Bnei Yisrael, until finally Hashem said, this generation, unfortunately, will not be able to go through.
What's going on?
So, we hope that we take this to heart and think about it. This is a very good, important lesson. We are also going to, we're going to speak also about another thing that's been going on recently. There's been some activity that we understand. There's been some activity of people. We want to just mention about the what sometimes different governments do.
Yeah, I've spoken a number of times on the air of suspected activity that of the United States government that doesn't seem on the up and up that I've encountered or some of my colleagues have encountered directly. And it seems on the surface to be that someone's trying to infiltrate our organization. And I'm always the first one to stand back and try to say, well, you know, maybe this is an honest attempt by somebody to join us. I never want to turn anybody away. I don't want to discourage anybody from calling us from whatever background they're calling and saying they want to be part of what we're doing. We're open to everyone to call us and whatever effort they can make to join with us or even they just want to talk with us. And that's energizing us also to know that people are listening to us and want to work with us on activities, on activism.
But now, Joe, I just want to mention over here that to apologize to our listeners because of the technical difficulties. Right now, over the air, is a mixture of music and what we are and our voices.
I see. Okay. I know there were.
So we don't want people to realize that you know we're speaking and. We do realize the technical difficulties that are happening even as we're speaking.
Yeah, they were definitely working on it at the studio there, and they're trying to fix it and put it together. So we apologize if it's a little challenging to hear us for some of our listeners. Basically, in the past, as I was saying, that we're always open. We give out our number on the air. We give out our name. And we welcome people to call us on the air, off the air, whether it's during our regular segment from 12:30 to 1 a.m. or our online segment, which follows on the internet, which people can hear just by going to the JewishActivistNetwork.com website and just click on the link for the 1 to 1:30 a.m. Segment, or whether they call us during the week on this number, we're open. But sometimes some of the calls we get are just too suspicious. They're just too something about them, and they have one thing in common, is that the caller will seem to be, or whoever is contacting us will seem to be on the up and up. They seem genuinely interested in helping us. You know, we ask them a few questions. They don't seem to be able to justify why they want to help us, but that's fine. We don't ask too many questions in that regard in general. But then somehow the conversation will turn to where they bring up something violent. And where they say something which is either they're engaged in something violent or they have violent tendencies or they want to engage us in something violent. And violent where I mean to the point of not just discussing something theoretical, they're basically discussing something that would be considered close, if not over the line of illegal. And of course, everything that we strive to do here at this point on the Jewish Activist Network is to do things legally. There are so many options here in the United States at this point in time that we can do. There's political options, there's free speech options like we're exercising right now on the air. So basically, it's only when it's over the top, way over the top, that people make comments that we begin to say something's out of order. And in particular, just to point to one example, there was somebody who was coming to a number of different groups, the same person. People would describe him, that, you know, say this person came and he's doing this, and would go from one group to another with kind of the same pattern. So it sounds like a conspiracy, you know, because that's the kind of thing that we always want to avoid. As we don't want to come across, if I can use the word, we don't want to come across as crazy, right? But there have been a number of articles now in the news, in the media, which seem to back up that we're not the only ones who are being targeted. And I want to mention one article in particular that that somebody sent me a copy of, and can show that what happened in one case in Southern California. Again, not, I can't say for sure in our cases, right? We haven't investigated things to that extent, but I do want to show that part of our activism, I think, is to show that the U.S. government has to back off sometimes in some of their activities, which are, I don't want to say illegal, but sort of very questionable what, how useful they are. So I'd like to talk about this article a little bit. And in this particular example, there was a man in Southern California, and he says that he was hired by the FBI to go into a mosque and to be an informant. Okay? That's what he says. He was hired by the FBI to actually go in and be an informant. Now, in that particular case, it seems to be somewhat justified from the article, but it does show that the U.S. government, through the FBI, is hiring people to go ahead and infiltrate organizations. Nothing dramatic there, nothing so strange. But the fact is that what's interesting is that the person they hired doesn't seem to be, I don't want to cast aspersions on him, but he doesn't seem to be such a fine mensch. I mean, he ended up basically in jail for a couple months on a theft charge. So you might want to wonder just how reliable he is. But basically, the story seems to document it pretty well that through the research that the reporter did, or that was done by the, this particular media, is that the at some point somebody in the mosque complained about this man and said that he was, you know, complained and thought that he was an informant. And it does show that there was a restraining court order brought out against him, that he couldn't go near that mosque after that. And it was also brought up in court that it, in a court case, that an FBI agent was testifying and was saying that that there was such an informant. So, I mean, if someone would go and look at the article, and we, certainly if you call us or contact us by email, we can send you the article. The upshot of the whole thing is that it seems pretty clear from circumstantial evidence and the research of this article that the FBI did indeed hire somebody to be an informant, and that this person was providing information. So, again, in that particular case, it may have been totally justified. In our cases, we don't think so. We really don't think so. And I'm saying that there's no reason to begin even such kind of activity. But I think this kind of an article, and we're not going to dwell on it too much, basically justifies our suspicions to some extent that that there the government is sending people in and trying to get us to be involved in things that are illegal, and that just doesn't seem right. We're not involved in anything illegal. We talk here on the radio, and that's it. Basically, we lobby on Capitol Hill. We talk on the radio. We use the political process, and we use free speech.
Now, this brings a question of I guess we could tie it into the past a little bit with in terms of faith. A lot of times, you have to try to take actions and do things, even against odds. And unfortunately, there are cases, as you were saying, that governments may not like what a person does, and they might do things which are quite questionable. I don't think there's anything wrong with going in and trying to see if there's anything illegal happening. The question is...
Let me interrupt you. There's nothing wrong with that. If a private organization, I think, may want to do that, at least according to the way the laws are set up here. But I think there is something wrong with the government going on a fishing expedition. I don't think that's their business. Their business is if a crime, if there seems to be a reason for a crime, go ahead, investigate, you know, go for it. But there has to be something to hang it on. So just to say, you know, just to say, well, we'll go and we're going to take a look, I don't think that's right.
Right. Well, I was going to say that the line is crossed when they try to get people to do things wrong.
Right.
You might be right that they shouldn't even go into check for no reason on anybody who has a presumption of innocence.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not. I guess what is considered to be a suspicion.
Okay,
so
right.
You could argue about that a little bit.
That's pretty broad.
But certainly.
Right. So let them go in, right. Let them, if they want to go in, they want to do surveillance, more.
To a certain extent, but you're right. The surveillance shouldn't be done on people without suspicion. There's a lot of, but there's an issue of privacy also.
Okay, but, we have
and
nothing.
The government shouldn't be doing that. But on the other hand.
We have nothing to hide. We have nothing to hide.
No. Yeah. But right. The point is that it sounds like from these articles that they're going well beyond that.
Well,
they're getting involved in entrapment.
In this particular case, it might have been somewhat justified. I mean, it was dealing, if I'm not mistaken, with the brother-in-law of the bodyguard of bin Laden, something like that. So, there may have been some level of justification.
Yeah, I don't know if there's any problem with suspecting that. On the other hand, the question is entrapment.
Entrapment.
And if it's used. I think it's used a lot of times. For different organizations, different people, if they're not interested, they don't like them, they'll try to entrap.
For political reasons, right.
Political reasons, absolutely.
Right. If somebody's doing something political, and we have to admit what we're doing is political, and I have to say that it's not very popular with the administration, starting with the Clinton administrations and onward, this kind of activity that we're doing, to say that there is a problem with the peace process, that the peace process is fundamentally wrong. That's clearly protected free speech. That's clearly protected political activism. And yet that clearly goes against what successive administrations have been wanting to do. So I could see their desire for political reasons to try to stir something up.
That's right. My phone number is 718-569-0921. I'd like to speak a little bit about faith from this parsha. And we're going to talk a little bit about Nachshon. The sages tell us that the Bnei Israel stood trembling by the Red Sea until Hashem commanded, "Go forward." Now this ties in what we were saying before. It was at the Yam Suf, at the Red Sea, where the Bnei Israel stood paralyzed in fear when they saw the Egyptians running after them. And that's, if anybody wants to look up the Eben Ezra is right there, right by the parasha where it talks about them, right before the Yam Suf. But Hashem said, "What are you crying to me? Speak to the children of Israel, and they should travel, move forward. It's time for action." At that time, nobody moved. Even though Hashem said, and Moshe told them that Hashem said, "Move," but they were paralyzed with fear. They didn't move. Only Nachshon did not hesitate to carry out Hashem's commandment. He lunged forward into the raging water, but nothing happened. Nachshon was not taken aback. He descended deeper into the water, up to his ankles, knees, stomach, and still nothing happened. Nachshon continued into the water until it reached up to his neck. Then he cried out to Hashem, quote, "O God, save me, because the water has come into my soul. I sink deep in mire where there is no standing." Only then did the miracle of the splitting of the sea occur. So what lesson do we learn from this? So, Joe, what do you think? Help me out with this. What do you see from what Nachshon did?
It seems to me from the plain meaning of the Pesukim that Hashem says to Moshe, hold out your staff and the waters will split. And now this is based on a Medrash, I take it, that you're reading. It seems to be that Nachshon now goes ahead and says, the waters are going to split. The fact that it doesn't seem like the waters are splitting isn't going to concern me at all. Hashem said the waters are going
to... Yeah. I'm not even sure he knew that it would split.
Hmm. Yeah. You're not even sure? Okay. So he may not have been aware of that,
right.
Fact that...
I just want to apologize again to our listeners if you hear the... Yeah. We didn't have the music interrupting for a while.
It's part of the...
But the music is kicked in now, so it's together with us.
Say again,
there's music together with us on the air, and I just want to apologize to the listeners, but I guess it's a nice backdrop.
So we'll try to speak up a little bit over the music.
I don't even think that Nachshon knew that it was going to split.
In other words, that you...
All he knew...
So the Nevuah
to Moshe... That's why I understand it. So he knew, go forward, that's it.
So the Nevuah to Moshe is that the waters will split. Moshe gives the command, or he himself takes on that he's going to move forward in that direction. I mean, why would he pick?
I wonder if Moshe was told at the point when he said travel, did he know at that point that it was going to split? Maybe he was told to raise his hand and split the water after Nachshon was trying, or it could be that he knew beforehand.
Okay, good point. I hadn't considered that.
It could be that Nachshon knew about it. I'm not sure what Nachshon knew about the splitting of the water and when Moshe was told to split the water.
Okay.
At what point?
That's a good point. In other words, was it only after Nachshon made the attempt? But then that begs the question: why did Nachshon take that direction? He could just as easily have turned around and picked up a rock, or you said they came out armed, so he could just as well have picked up a machine gun or whatever arms they had. I take it they didn't have machine guns, but whatever, a sword or something, he could have taken that sword in his hand and moved towards the Egyptian army, and they're going to be bearing down on him, and he gets closer, and they're bearing down even more on him, and he could also call out to Hashem, why move in the direction of the water rather than in the direction of the Egyptians? In fact, isn't there a medrash? I can't quote it directly. Isn't there a medrash that says, and this is in distinction perhaps to what Eben Ezra was saying, that one group wanted to fight, one group wanted to try to make peace, one group was suicidal, one group was davening.
That could be, but that still could all work out, simply because if the people who wanted to fight were a minority, that wouldn't do the trick.
Okay, and they also could give up and melt away because they want to fight, and they look around and they see they don't have that kind of unity that is necessary for a nation to fight, because only a free nation can have that unity, and a nation of slaves is a nation of individuals and doesn't come together to fight a battle.
Right, and just following what you just said, it could even be that Nachshon himself was one of the people that would have fought. It's very possible,
right.
But ultimately, at the end of the day, nobody was fighting.
So Nachshon turned...
And Moshe asked Hashem, what do we do? They're coming after us, we're melting in fear.
Based on that background,
Hashem said, start moving to the water.
Does Moshe ask, or does Hashem come to Moshe, who's davening, and saying, yeah, okay, so you want to say Moshe
is
davening.
What is davening? Davening is asking.
So Hashem says not to cry out, to go ahead and, okay, so we don't know at what point, did Nachshon know, okay, that requires investigation, Sirich Ion.
Right.
Did Nachshon know that Moshe had gotten this command that he was to split the waters, or did it come after Nachshon made the effort? But the point is, Nachshon took a direction that he thought would be, that on the surface, did not look viable, and he said, you know, we have to do something, I'm going to move in this direction, Hashem has made all these miracles for us in Mitzrayim, we need a miracle here, and at the very least, we got to move somewhere, we got to move away from this enemy. If we're not going to fight this enemy, and we don't want to stand where we are and get slaughtered,
right,
the only other option is to move into the water.
Right.
It's very
now,
much...
My assumption, just from reading it, is that Nachshon knew, go forward. And based on that,
he moved forward.
He went forward. That's just at this point, unless somebody could show me differently. That's my assumption, that Nachshon only knew that, and he wasn't told of any type of miracle. That would match up to other times, for example, that Avraham Avinu, right, our father Abraham, was thrown into a burning furnace. He knew that he could not bow down to an idol by Nineveh. And he was thrown into the furnace. Did he know that there would be a miracle performed to him? No, that happened later, after he took the step. So that would match up with that idea with Nachshon also. He didn't know that a miracle was going to happen. He just knew to move forward. And at the point where he was about to drown, it was when he cried out. And he said, I'm doing what you're saying, so help me now.
Or to move forward, they say that the Akeda was uprooted, so to speak. That's brought down. I can't quote it. Forgive me. But the Akeda was uprooted when Bnei Israel moved into that water. And I think that fits in well with what you're saying. Avram was told to move forward and follow the command of God and sacrifice. Seemingly, the command was to sacrifice his son, and he moved forward. Nachshon followed in that line that Avraham showed us how to do and said, I'll move forward right into the water, whatever it takes.
So the lesson is clear. Together with prayer, Hashem demands maximal effort. It's only through actual deeds that a person's faith is tested. Sometimes we have people saying, well, let us, we believe in our hearts, or we don't have to do anything to show. But the truth is, only action is what really shows if a person really is serious and has real faith and trust in God. So even jumping into the stormy waters was not sufficient. In other words, he got into the stormy waters. He got a little bit, but no, he went further, because there's still the opportunity to back out if he didn't get all the way deep. Only by going all the way is the way to show our faith, not just with our mouths, but with our actions. Now, because based on this, what happened here with Nachshon, and climbing the Gulf War, actually, Binyamin Kahana, he was talking about what he felt was a mistake of those religious Jews who sanctified the quote-unquote self-restraint policy during the Gulf crisis. When Hashem sees this chosen people scurrying like roaches into the sealed-off closets, this is what he was saying then, and I want to get your opinion, what you think about this. While the modern-day Goliath blaspheme God and his people for 40 days and viewed it as a positive thing. In other words, you have religious people, I understand, so you can understand the person being fearful and trying to just show self-restraint. But it's the idea that they felt that you had people talking about it as if it was a positive. This is the right one thing to do. And they didn't feel that it was a desecration of God's name. This type of idea, and then saying God will help, does not, a person who talks like this does not begin to grasp what the Jewish concept of faith is all about. Because genuine faith is active participation in the historical processes. It's a performance of actions that seem to cry out danger, but which we do in full trust and faith. So, and he believes that not only did we lose our deterrent factor and our dignity during the Gulf War, but also proved our lack of faith. And it is the same lack of faith that has prevented us from expelling the Arabs, annexing the territories, and settling all of Eretz Israel. It is only a lack of faith that has brought us to the pathetic and desperate situation we now find ourselves in today. This is what he wrote. And the truth is, we find the same thing now, very, very similarly, when we are, through a lack of faith, we don't want to do the right thing. And we are caving into all sorts of demands of the world. And we are getting in a worse and worse and more desperate and desperate situation. Do you?
Well, the only look, I agree with you that we have to kind of jump in and jump into the water.
Right.
But I not to take the other side, not to be an apologist.
No, go ahead.
The other side is, and I have heard people who are learned espouse this, and they're not espousing it on their own. They're in touch with other Jewish scholars, and basically, that there's a risk involved, and we understand that there's a risk involved, and their idea is that if at this very moment you can squeeze out a little bit more of keeping the status quo the way things are by not taking that risk, let's keep squeezing out another 5 minutes, another 10 minutes, another year, another 6 months, whatever it is, and let's just keep, if I could use the word, and it's not a nice word, muddling along, right? Just trying to fudge everything and just try to get just see if we can keep going. Okay, there'll be a bus bombing here, God forbid, or a mini war here or there, or rockets falling into a town and everyone there is distressed. But if we can just keep it going a little bit longer. So that we're just about out of time. We'll continue this discussion online.
I think it's an interesting discussion.
And those are the two sides. Whether to quote Shakespeare, to be or not to be, and that's basically.
But which one is it, to be, and which one's the not to be?
To be is what we're saying. To be is to jump in the water. Let's ask everybody to join us again, online at JewishActivistNetwork.com. We'll continue this discussion and next week on AM 620, hopefully without technical difficulties. Thank you for tuning in tonight.